Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome all of you to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're still in contact 141 and 142, but as you know, I tend to like to pull things in from other sources. And I wanted to read to you a little bit about Billy's contact with Svoth. And at this point, Billy's about 5 years old. I believe this is his actual first physical contact with Svoth. He's met Svoth and gone in his ship, and he's in the ship with Svoth, some 70,000 meters above the Earth. And Svoth is about to put this device on his head that opens up wisdom from his former personalities. So let me read this. This is amazing. At that time, the stay with Svoth lasted a little bit more than 4 hours, during which he provided me with immense knowledge. By the end of the gathering, he asked me to lie back in my armchair, after which he then put a funny structure of countless wires and the smallest apparatuses, etc., around my head. Speculating what would follow, I watched him calmly, how he was meddling with apparatuses, buttons, and switches, and then suddenly I heard and saw tremendous things in me. Everything was suddenly and simply in me, and immense knowledge, insights, and all sorts of things. I felt as quiet, suddenly strange forces penetrated inside me, as I suddenly became capable of recognizing things and events of the future. Wanted to cure people of illnesses by use of any force and many other things. Then this influence again suddenly stopped, and Svoth removed the funny device from my head with the explanation that I would now possess all the abilities which has been inputted to me by the apparatus, but which, however, already was developed in me from earlier times. Now I would never lose these abilities again, only I might never bring them egotistically or simply apply them for the purpose of profit or demonstration. This he explained me then. He also applied to scientific tests and to whatever forcible external influence should attempts be made to penetrate into my knowledge and my abilities, for example, by hypnosis. Thus, the blockade would appear, also in this respect, and doom all attempts, etc., to fail. Besides, the blockade is to such extent strong that, under certain circumstances, would even endanger the life of those who would undertake forcible intrusion attempts. This was also the case, something I several times came to notice in the course of my life. So Edward Albert Meyer, this one-armed farmer from Switzerland, begins his life as a young boy growing up in the beautiful Swiss countryside. And then at the age of 4 and 5 years old, he starts getting these telepathic messages from a 1,000-year-old extraterrestrial man named Svoth, who is going to be his mentor for the first 11 years of his life. And Svoth taught Billy many things. Particularly, he also taught Billy about something called the creation or the universal consciousness. The universal consciousness is the superintelligence which runs our universe, and it's neither good nor evil. It builds universes as a part of its own evolution. There are millions of universes, universes within universes, universes adjacent to universes. Our universe is called the Dern universe. There's also a sister parallel universe to ours called the Tao universe, which was created 46 trillion years ago. And there are estimated to be 100 to 200 billion galaxies in our universe. Our galaxy is called the Milky Way galaxy. It's about 100,000 light years across. It has 450 billion stars in it, and it's divided into different time planes or time-space configurations. Spoth and his people are from a different time-space configuration than the people on our world. The Pleiaren live some 80 light years beyond our visible Pleiades, in another space-time configuration. Their planet is called Era, and in many respects, it's similar to Earth in terms of its ecosystem, in terms of its size. It has a thicker atmosphere. The animals probably are very similar. Many, in ancient times, the Pleiaren brought animals and plants from the Earth. But the people there are different, and they live in a balance with nature. They keep their population at about 500 million. They don't build roads. They don't drive across the surface of their planet. They don't use money. They don't pollute the air, the water. They don't pollute the land. Their cities are small. They don't manufacture anything on their world. They live in a complete balance with nature because they understand that everything in the universe is one and it's all bound together. One of Billy's later contacts, Sannyasi, would say that love and wisdom go together and that the creation and its laws are love and wisdom at the same time. So we have the spiritual energetic version or aspect of the universal consciousness, which is described as a Wesenheiten in the German, similar to gas or water in its nature. And then we also have the physical aspect of the creation. And Billy would always comment that the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and that creation radiates love, and that every moment and every place and every day we can experience the radiating love of creation, and that you should be able to look at a tree and appreciate that love is the highest principle in creation, and that everything follows that principle, and that every tiny plant and every tiny animal has a purpose in creation, and that nothing would exist that does exist if it were not for the love of creation. And experiencing the love of creation, being able to perceive it, depends on your ability to observe, particularly nature. And this process of observing and sensing the radiating love of creation is called Empfinden. And it's a spiritual process. It's part and parcel to having this controlling factor called the Gemut in your human spirit, which controls the thoughts and feelings associated to your human spirit. And the human spirit, remember, is invulnerable to harm, cannot be hurt. It resides in the superior colliculus of your midbrain, in the area associated with sight, and it sends out an animating force that brings life into your physical body. Now, the human spirit functions with neutral positive thinking. It's a neutral positive entity, like the creation, like the universal consciousness. And there is this indissoluble web of life And all the creatures in the web of life are connected. Billy calls it by psychic swinging waves. I have a clip of the work of a scientist named Cleve Baxter, who is starting, or has to a certain extent, proven some of the aspects of this universal consciousness. And let me play this clip or part of this clip, and we'll talk about it afterwards and how it relates back to some of the things mentioned in the Meyer case.
My supreme acknowledgement to Mother Nature and her many creations, whose life forms have passed through the lab and revealed to my curious mind their often hidden capabilities. Cleve Baxter. There is a saying in China, they do not come alone, but in pairs. Soon after Baxter detected that plants have feelings, he made new, more serendipitous discoveries. One of them occurred as follows. Baxter was cracking eggs to prepare animal feed when he saw that the polygraph pen immediately started swinging. This triggered a thought. What will happen if electrodes are attached to an egg? Thus, on May 24, 1966, Baxter conducted measurements on a non-fertile egg in his New York lab.
This is a tracing from the egg on a particular day. I can't get a tracing like this too often, but you see these little gyrations here? This is the heartbeat, an accurate rate of the heartbeat of an egg embryo that would be around 2 or 3 days along in incubation. But this is a non-fertile egg. A non-fertile egg. I show this to my polygraph people, just a little piece of this, and say, what's going on here? They say, well, that's somebody that has a real fast heartbeat, and they seem to be moving here, and maybe they're trying countermeasures. And I say, what's wrong with you? After 7.5 weeks, you don't know. That's an egg. Anyway.
After Baxter found that plants have feelings and eggs have heartbeats, the plants in his lab were often attached with various measuring devices. He discovered a pattern. The highest quality results came from experiments that were carried out under random conditions. In other words, those experiments occurred spontaneously rather than being purposefully arranged.
Doing long-term monitoring of the plant life, I worked late at night and I had some yogurt in the refrigerator because I sometimes would miss meals. And so I decided I was going to have a container of yogurt that had strawberry jam in the bottom. And when I turned up the strawberry jam into the yogurt, the plant reaction just went crazy.
Here, the jacana plant was not in direct contact with the strawberry jam. The jacana was like an onlooker, observing Baxter eating his yogurt. When he only ate the yogurt without touching the strawberry, the jacana cane did not show any reaction. When he spooned the strawberry from the bottom of the yogurt, the jacana plant reacted.
And when I put that spoon in the yogurt and turned it up, it changed immensely. And as I look back on it, the only thing that could have happened is that the jam was either nutrient to the yogurt cells above it, or there was some kind of preservative in the jam that was affecting the cells that had not been in direct contact. And so I thought, wow, you know, this I didn't realize that there were live bacteria in yogurt.
In other words, it is possible that the jacana perceived the microorganism's response to stimulation and then responded accordingly. So what kind of sensing capability did the microorganisms in the yogurt have? Baxter discovered mutual responses among the bacteria on January 4th, 1976, in a lab in San Diego.
Now this is interesting. We're not only are bacteria conscious, where bacteria are tuned into other bacteria of a different type, friendly versus unfriendly bacteria. And watch what's happening here. Sam, the Siamese cat, we got hooked on chicken. Lisa convinced me of that. We'd eat nothing but roasted chicken. Here is where I removed the chicken from the refrigerator, This is what, four rooms away from where the yogurt is being, the friendly bacteria is being monitored, the yogurt. And this is the yogurt tracing right here. And here I'm starting to strip the chicken from the carcass. This is a pretty old carcass now, and it's starting to get a bacterial buildup on it. Well, cats can handle that because they got a strong digestive system, but the bacteria were there. And here I'm disturbing the bacteria when I'm stripping it off the chicken. And here I put it under a heating lamp to bring it up to room temperature. Here, when the heat from the heating lamp hits the chicken in the dish, it is affecting the unfriendly bacteria to where the bacteria way up in the front room, is showing reaction. Here's the friendly to the unfriendly bad guy bacteria on the chicken. Okay, the next one shows where then I stirred the chicken, took the cold chicken from the bottom of the dish, put it to the top, and again put it back under the heating lamp. And here's what's happening up in the front room recording of the friendly bacteria of the yogurt. And here is the unfriendly bacteria that is coating this chicken. And here I set the dish down and the Sam started to eat the chicken. Here is about the time it took, just about 10 seconds, for the chicken to hit the digestive juices of the cat. The word goes out and it flatlines from then on. In other words, the bacteria just stopped reacting.
Now, are there connections between a main body and the individual cells separated from the main body? This is a more fascinating question. Baxter found the answer with further experiments. He used a centrifuge to separate the cells gathered from a donor's mouth. Baxter connected the polygraph to the white blood cells, or leukocytes, and, through the donor's emotional changes, was able to observe the cell's response. The donor was a petrochemical business merchant. At the time, he was reading a news report about a congressional hearing concerning the implementation of additional controls over the chemical industry. When he became indignant, his cells responded likewise. Baxter also carried out many experiments on a cell's conscious response.
When I had gotten the proper equipment to do my own white cell collection, because I had to get a centrifuge out of it, first I tried the procedure in collecting my own cells, but then on a session when Steve was there, I let him collect his own cells. And he knew the collection procedure, went through it, the whole procedures. We electroded the cells, and then thing that I did with him is I put a camera over his shoulder as he was reading a magazine. And the magazine, there was an article about, by somebody, Shockley, I believe was the guy's name, that was controversial at the time. And we got into a discussion about that. I said, well, gee whiz, my partner have Playboy magazine down in his desk drawer because he subscribes to it. So we went down, we found the issue, came back up. And not only did he find the Shockley article, but as he leaped through with the camera over his shoulder and his white cells being monitored, he got to the centerfold, which was a Bo Derek. And this is when there was that huge reaction. After that, he could see that he knew what was going on in his mind and knew what he saw on those pages. And I think that was for him the same as my February 2nd, 1966 observation was. It really was so powerful an observation that I don't think he was a skeptic anymore. I think he was with the program.
Cleve and I were discussing things in the lab, and we talked about a lot of things. And William Shockley was a physicist, and he had some very, very racially unpopular views, let's say, about genetics. And so we're discussing that, and I mentioned, I think it was a Playboy article. And he said, do you know which one? I go, no. I mean, I had no clue. And so we went down and looked and found it was the current month or whatever, and got up there, and so we're looking through the article about the genetics. And then Cleve came up with this great idea, since we had the camera over my shoulder and my white cells attached. Why don't you look through the rest of the magazine? See what happens. Okay. So I was looking through things other than articles, and I came to one photo that actually seemed really nice. And when it happened, my cells just went crazy. Okay, the ones that were electroded. It was rather embarrassing, to say the least, and now I'm telling everybody about it, but that's okay. At the time, I was a college student, and here I am hooked up to my white cells, and reading a Playboy magazine, and my cells are just reacting. And it turns out it was one of the longest pronounced reactions that we've seen. It lasted like 2.5 minutes or so. And finally, Clay said, wait a second, we can't keep doing this. So I said, okay, so I closed the magazine down, slid up out of the way. Okay, I'm just going to try to calm my mind down. Close my eyes. Just before I started to reach for the magazine, another large spike. And so we all were getting a good laugh out of it.
And this is what happened here. And it continued to happen. Then finally I said, Steve, why don't you close the magazine? Maybe this will quiet down, which it did here. Then he was going to double cross me, and he reached for the magazine, and just reaching for the magazine caused that spike. You know? So
I think it's extremely important. I think it's very, very important. I think something that needs to be done. My ratio in interacting with people can't be one-to-one to that stagnant. It will tie you up onto a million. Things that I can do that will affect a million people is what I'm trying to do. Nine is a very important number in my life, and I'm 81 now. That adds up to a nine, right? And the next time nine comes around is when I'm 90. So I'm going to give it my all until I'm 90 anyway.
It just, I mean, nobody can get him off course. I mean, it's something that he feels that it's very significant. And there are so few people that have that much conviction to go forward when everybody else is telling you they're wasting time and they're never going to make any money. But that's not the goal. The goal is not to make money. It's to get this research out.
On no budget, no money for publicity, just me and my computer and letters, it's got this far. And hopefully this research will open up some doors.
To those who wonder why I felt such confidence, as one person who has experienced the indifference of many scientists in this field, I can simply state that such high resistance to new ideas does not concern me. I have a truly wonderful ally, Mother Nature. Cleve Baxter.
I hope you enjoyed that clip. It's quite interesting. It's about a man named Grover Cleveland Baxter. He actually worked for a while for the Central Intelligence Agency, but he's best known for his experiments with plants using a polygraph instrument in 1960, which led to his theory of primary perception, where he claimed that plants feel pain and have extrasensory perception. His study of plants began in the 60s, and he reported observing that a polygraph instrument attached to a plant leaf registered a change in electrical resistance when the plant was harmed or even threatened with harm. His work was inspired by the research of a physicist named Jagdish Chandra Bose, who claimed to have discovered that playing certain kinds of music in the area where plants grow caused them to grow faster. Bose used a device called a cressograph to measure plant response to various stimuli, and he demonstrated feeling in plants. From the analysis of the variation of the cell membrane potential of plants under different circumstances, he hypothesized that plants feel pain, understand affection, etc. He wrote two books about it in 1902 and 1926. Now, one of the interesting tests that Cleve Baxter went on to perform was He attached electrodes to these plant leaves, and he could register something like a galvanic response in our skin when they do lie detector. You know, they can measure an electrical change based on your thoughts and based on your emotions, and the plants, they register the same response. But like if he would think of burning the plant, it would register the response. You could see a little device that was displaying these higher waves. Just Cleve thinking of harming that plant would cause this increased response. And of course, if he harmed the plant, it would also have the response. Now, the interesting thing is, the Russians did tests, the same kind of tests, where they would hook two plants to these electrodes, and a woman would come in and start tearing leaves off one of the plants. Well, the other plant that was not harmed would also register these galvanic responses. And not only that, when the woman came back into the room later, the plant that wasn't harmed would have these big responses just to the presence of that woman. Like it was aware that woman was in the room, the one that was tearing the leaves off the other plant, his buddy there, so to speak. Not only that, this indicated a communication from plant to plant, and that the plants were aware somehow, conscious somehow, of the humans in the room. Well, not only that, when they did experiments with brine shrimp where they would literally boil them, and the plants responded again when those shrimp were boiled. And then once the shrimp died, the response went away. So there seems to be this, as the Meyer material says, this interconnectedness to all things. And like Spoth told Billy, everything in the universe is one, and it's all bound together. And my favorite quote from The Gobble of Truth, the paragraph that's entitled What the Truth Knows to Say, it says, rivers, lakes, stones, the earth, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involved many, many lifetimes. And that death is just the passage to rebirth. Rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected by psychic vibrations. And they're aware of each other. And when you go into the forest, you can hear these creatures communicate, and they're connected by these psychic vibrations. You can hear the frogs, the peepers, the birds. Now, I like to say the birds sing because they're aware of this radiating love of creation. I'm going to read just a couple of verses here from chapter 22 of the Goblet of Truth. Very profound. I'm still contemplating them. You human beings, you are part of the universe with its immutable eternal laws and recommendations of the creation, in which a purpose for existence is also determined for you, the sense of life which is given in relatively highest possible evolution of the consciousness. And if you recognize this life purpose and life sense and bring it into relationship with your own existence at every hour, every day, and at all times, then you will unavoidably recognize yourselves and be Lord and Master over yourselves. And if you are Lord and Master of yourselves, then you will be able to arrange your surroundings in a favorable wise through your knowledge and your wisdom in order to do things of the right, of the fairness, and of the progress, as well as of the evolution of the consciousness. With such knowledge and such wisdom, however, worries, affliction, misery, and hardship, as well as deeper sorrow and pain, can be overcome. Therefore, the real life is made up of more than just those things that are learned and taken in as school knowledge, because truly there is a really true and higher regulation in life, which is based on creational laws and recommendations, from out of which everything comes forth, which becomes and passes. Therefore, it is through this regulation that the becoming and the passing is determined, as well as causality, cause and effect. So we live in a very interconnected universe, and that the work of Cleve Baxter shows this very much so. So that is the universal consciousness. Back to Contact 141. Now, we learned that there's this group of extraterrestrials called the Hasters, which the Pleiaren brought to the Earth. They live in another galaxy. It's called the GENAN galaxy. It's some hundreds of light years away. The Hasters are about 1,127 years ahead of us in development. So their vibrations, their auric vibes, are more compatible with ours than the Pleiaren. And they can be in our presence for some 17 hours before they start to lose control of themselves. So it's interesting that these different races, depending on their development, can tolerate our negative auric vibes longer. The Pleiaren cannot tolerate our negative auric vibes as long as the Hasters can. In any sense, the Pleiaren have helped the Hasters build a base in the North Sea here on the Earth. And these extraterrestrials, humans, have a base in our North Sea. So they must be here studying us for whatever reason. The North Sea is a marginal sea of the Atlantic Ocean. It's located between Great Britain, Scandinavia, Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. It's north of England and Germany. So are the Hasters still there? I don't know. I would like to think so. The other extraterrestrial group that's still on the Earth that we've talked about before are the Hyperboreans, and they have a city located in Mount Shasta of about 700 people. They are a blonde race. They seem to be related to the white people here on the Earth. They're blondes. They sometimes will come out of their city there. You can sometimes see their golden spherical spacecraft come out of the eastern slope of Mount Shasta, and sometimes they will have visitors from other worlds that come in. They are a very old race. They've been on the Earth here between 180,000 and 190,000 years. So you could almost think of them as Earth people. They've been here so long, but they're not from here. But many of us, many of the races on Earth are not from here. At times they will use these beam weapons, kind of in a stun mode against certain Earth humans that come too close to their bases. They also have a base in the Aleutian Islands. At one time, I believe they did live on the surface. There was an Ishwish from the Hyperboreans who communicated with the person that we call Noah today. Noah's original name was Noah Kadnasser, and he got some of his wisdom from one of these kings of wisdom, these Ishwishes, that was a Hyperborean. And evidently he helped him design the Ark or whatever. Now, the Hyperboreans had... There was a place on the Earth at one time called Hyperborea, and that was when the axis of the Earth was different. And I think that Florida was much higher north, and it was in a polar region. Our polar regions at that time were fantastic places to be for some reason. They were very warm. They were perfect weather. It was just wonderful. So the Earth changed after the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria. Our pole shifted, and there was a horrific global disaster. And the Earth has been through more than one of these global disasters. And I wanted to play a clip. I may not play that much of it. It's about Mount Shasta and Mount St. Helens. It's a pretty old clip. The sound quality is fair to middling, but I think it gives us a good overview of what these places are like. So we'll listen to this for a while, and then I want to jump back to our discussion here.
Presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanation, but not necessarily the only one, to the mysteries we will examine. Devastation used to be Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens is just one of many Cascade volcanoes. Which of these slumbering giants might awaken next? The towering splendor that was Mount St. Helens. The green slopes were the home of thousands of forest creatures. The refuge of nature lovers. Thousands hiked her trails. Families camped beneath her trees. Loggers harvested her vast forests. Vacationers came to fish along the banks of Spirit Lake, nestled high on the slope of the mountain. The
Geyser Spirit Lake feed the Toodle River, which winds down the mountain and through the valley towns below. Towns which had never thought of danger from the volcano that loomed above. Until the spring of 1980, when the mountain began to heat from within. Her shroud of ice and snow began to melt. She began to shudder and swell, angrily belching forth steam and rock. Then, on May 18th, it was one of the most powerful volcanic blasts ever recorded. Over 200 square miles were destroyed. The entire wildlife population was buried beneath billions of tons of ash and rock, or burned to death by the incredible heat of the explosion. Acidic ash rained from the sky, smothering the few trees left standing. The icy blue water of Spirit Lake turned to boiling gray mud. It surged over its banks, combining with the enormous volume of glacial melt. This wall of water and mud raced through the bed of the Toodle River, inundating the countryside below. Devastating farms, home, and lifestyles. Mrs. Adrian Johnson was with her family on the Toodle River the night the muds came.
When the muds started to come, which was in the evening around 7:30, it was incredible. You just couldn't believe that it would take everything. It, like my husband said, you know, it will never get that high. We stood on my girlfriend's deck and we watched, and it was like passing. It would, you know, it would just come like waves. It was terrible. You could hear these horrid sounds. You could say, there goes the neighbor house. These are neighbors here. Now the only time that they come by is to see if they can salvage something. The solitude now, it is. Just devastation. You get up in the morning and all you see is destruction.
The shipping channel of the Cowlitz River now runs just 6 inches deep in places, clogged with 1.5 million acre feet of mud and debris. Nearly 500,000 fish died from suffocation and heat. Hundreds of human lives might also have been lost were it not for the planning of people like Cowlitz County Sheriff Les Nelson.
We started our action, of course, with this volcano. Most people relate to it as being of May the 18th. March is when this department had to start thinking about getting into action. And because of the threat and the information that we received, of course, we were concerned about our people.
An evacuation plan was developed. Warning brochures were distributed. The county went into action. Involved in these activities was Under-Sheriff William Stewart.
Prior to the eruption on May the 18th, we had set up several roadblocks into the dangerous areas around the mountain. Warning people who came to those roadblocks that it was dangerous. Yet they still went in, and we feel that a lot of the ones that are still missing are there because of ignoring our warning.
Yes, people did die at Mount St. Helens. Many are still missing. Luckily, though, there are no towns dotting her hillside or lying at her base like those at Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, or Mount Shasta. How many lives might be lost when those mountains erupt? When Mount St. Helens last erupted in 1857, her activity continued for 25 years. This time, how long will her rumbling go on?
We're still on an alert where we're not comfortable. my personal feeling, and that's all that I'm expressing here, however, based on some conversations with the geologists, is that I think the mountain's going to blow again. Maybe not in the magnitude, but I don't think that thing's ready to go back to sleep.
At Centers for Volcanic Study, like the University of Oregon, much knowledge has been gained. Molten material is tested. Rocks are analyzed. Temperatures and measurements are taken. But a real understanding of the volcano still eludes the scientists. Noted volcanologist Dr. Alex McBurney of the University of Oregon.
Basically, a volcano is any vent to the Earth's crust by which molten material is able to rise to the surface and fall out.
Volcanoes are one of the things that the Meyer material does seem to make predictions about. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about some of the prophecies in the Henoch, or Contact 215, the Henoch prophecies. Remember, the spirit of Edward Albert Meyer has incarnated as at least seven different personalities on the earth. He has been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. There were three incarnations of Enoch, or Henoch, as he's called. The one of most importance occurred in 8903 BC. And according to the prophecies of Henoch, the truth about industrialized countries is that they only appear to be true civilizations, but in fact they are not. Because more and more, at the end of the 20th century, at the beginning of the third millennium, remember we're in that age called the third millennium, which began when the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Spoth told Billy that we are entering into this time called the third millennium. And some of the dangers of the third millennium that are talked about in the Goblet of Truth, it says that people will become indolent and obtuse in the third millennium, meaning lazy and not real bright. And he goes on to say that people will be indifferent to one another. And this will lead to antagonisms among people. In Contact 72, I think it says that a time of maliciousness and confusion is about to spread over the earth. And in the third millennium, our leaders will become megalomaniacal, and they will take away our rights of self-determination. And it says here in Contact 215 that in the third millennium, they will disregard all true love, true freedom, and true wisdom, as well as true peace, along with all values of humaneness and all values of men and women's true being. But not even all the terrible happenings will hinder the U.S. in continuing to proceed with her actions. Now, this is the prophetic passage, line 227, that I quote a lot. Even when the North American continent will be stricken by the most terrible, catastrophic catastrophe which has ever been recorded, evil military powers will wreak havoc with computerized nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, whereby it will also happen that computerized weapons will become independent and cannot be controlled any longer by human beings. Overall, this is the most important part of Henoch's prophecies. And it goes on here to talk about some of the diseases that will come during our time here. It says, you are untiring, so I will point out a few more important facts of the prophecies. As of now, new epidemics will spread among the people of Earth. However, as Henoch prophesied, quite a number of further epidemics will follow. Not only AIDS will occur worldwide in the 1990s, but also epidemics such as the so-called mad cow disease, IEBSE, out of which different strains of the Creutzfeldt-Jacobs syndrome will develop, lasting well into the new millennium. Also, an epidemic known as Ebola will cause many deaths, as well as other unknown epidemics and diseases, which will sporadically arise in epidemic proportions and will be new to the human being, causing great concern. So yes, Ebola is mentioned in the prophecies of Henoch. And there will be, and there are currently, Ebola infections in the U.S.
The Ebola outbreak is raging throughout West Africa now. For the first time, a case of Ebola made its way back to the United States without anyone catching it first. The patient is currently under a quarantine in a Dallas hospital, and the CDC is reacting to the news. For more information on the threat of Ebola, we're turning to Mike Adams. He's a regular here on the program. He's also got a new website out called biodefense.com, which gives practical tips to hygiene and to protect yourself from Ebola. Mike, thanks for joining us. The Daily Mail is now just releasing information that up to 12 people could in fact be infected with Ebola, including 5 children. It was revealed today as U.S. health officials are scrambling to contain the deadly virus following first diagnosis on U.S. soil. Just before we went to air, you mentioned that the timeline now could in fact be that this person caught the Ebola virus in the airplane. Could you elaborate?
Yes. Thanks, Gary, for inviting me to your show. We don't know really the origins of the infection for this individual who's in Dallas. We don't even know his name. The government hasn't released much information. But the timeline of him beginning to show symptoms really lines up with the possibility that he may have contracted the infection on the airplane as he was traveling, which means there could be another patient zero who has already spread the infection to other people, and that patient may be running around somewhere in the United States, yet undiagnosed. They might be in a hospital right now under care for a severe flu or something. Keep in mind that the hospital at first did not know that this individual had Ebola. They sent him back home with antibiotics, which are useless against Ebola. They allowed him to potentially infect other people for 10 days in the Dallas area. And the important point of this, Gary, is that the United States government, which keeps telling us that we have nothing to worry about, that they have everything under control, has now been clearly proven wrong. They don't have this under control. It's out of control, and it has now crossed the Atlantic Ocean and is now in America, spreading among potentially many people.
Now, Mike, in the program today, we've already revealed that that reporters in Atlanta have revealed that instructions have been given to funeral parlors on how to handle Ebola bodies, cadavers, as well as we reported just a few months ago that the National Guard has already received Ebola detection kits. President Obama has already issued an executive order allowing the forced roundup of American citizens in the event that this becomes widespread. Obviously, these are all very frightening scenarios that nobody wants to see play out. What do you think is going to happen here? Because of the timeline of this individual going into the hospital, it takes several days for other symptoms, other people to show the signs. Are we seeing? Could we possibly see an exponential growth of this outbreak within the next 30 days?
Well, it's certainly possible. I do believe that the CDC may be able to contain this one particular outbreak from this one person. But the real question is, this guy flew right in. Someone could walk right into the United States with Ebola. There is zero defense. Homeland Security is completely defenseless against Ebola coming into the United States. People are able to just fly directly from Liberia or Sierra Leone to one other airport, and then boom, they're right into the United States. So we are defenseless against this here. The CDC only has limited resources, limited personnel. They may be able to clamp down on one infection, maybe two, maybe three, but what about 50? And keep in mind that Ebola likes to spread during the winter, and winter is coming in North America. That's going to provide more opportunities for Ebola to spread. It likes the cold weather. It also, it's afraid of sunlight, but it likes the darkness. So if you think about areas where Ebola could spread in the United States, think about the New York subway system. It's underground. There's no sunlight down there, so there's no ultraviolet light to dismantle the protein chains of the virus. And people are moving amongst each other very rapidly. It has the potential to spread extremely quickly in a city with a subway system or any kind of a public transportation system that's underground. So we are not being told the truth. This is far more serious than the government is admitting. And yes, to answer your question, it does have the potential to spread exponentially, not just in the next month or two, but over the next few years. They might keep it under control right now, but then next spring it really explodes in some city in the United States or Mexico City or even in Canada. Now that it's on the continent of North America, it could go anywhere.
Mike, you mentioned the travel, and I want to get into the markets and some of the reactions there. But what about the British and the UK? They've canceled all flights into and out of the infected nations, but we're still allowing travel. What are some simple solutions that the American government could take or should take?
Well, they should have long ago canceled travel in and out of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea by air. Air travel is obviously the fastest way for this virus to spread. That should have been shut down long ago. What we see here with the United States government in every catastrophe, including Hurricane Katrina, for example, is that the government is too little too late. And while in certain disasters, such as the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, the BP oil spill from a few years ago, you can eventually clean it up because oil doesn't self-replicate. You know, it doesn't double every 30 days. Ebola is a self-replicating disaster that will spread out of control, out of containment, very, very quickly if you don't get on top of it. A university...
Anyway, we're seeing the Henoch prophecies played out here in North America. We've seen the raging firestorms come across the western parts of our country, particularly the Rim Fire last year, which destroyed about 400 square miles of wooded area in Northern California. Now the Carlton Complex Fire in Washington State, the largest fire in the history of Washington State. Anyway, and now we've got Ebola. We'll be back, folks. Tomorrow night I'll be talking with Frosty Woolridge about population problems, and I'll be on freedomslips.com. I don't think we're going to simulcast. Anyway, thanks so much for joining me, and we'll talk to you all very soon. Have a fantastic evening.